continue where we left off this morning. Yeah. So we are looking at the life of the Buddha to be before his awakening and all the various events that happen at this particular point. And we have seen how he decides to go forth and become a monastic. And then all the considerations that go into that. And now that he has gone forth, what does he do next? And one of the interesting things about the Buddha is that when he goes forth, the first thing that he does is to seek out teachers, other teachers that are already around, and to learn from them before he actually strikes out on his own. So there's a sense of even though he's the kind of the greatest spiritual master in human history, still he looks for teachers. Yeah, he doesn't kind of just go out and do his own thing. Yeah, and there's this sense of humility in a sense that I'll see what is available before I go out and do my own thing. Yeah. And I think this is true for spiritual life as it is for any kind of life, is that you learn from those who are already there. If you want to become a doctor, you don't just set up a clinic and say, I'm a doctor now. You go to university first, yeah? You learn about being a doctor. If you're a lawyer, you don't start kind of giving out advice about the law. You go to law school, first of all, to understand a few things about the law. And the spiritual life is really no different from that. You need some advice beforehand, before you start out. And this is what this really comes down to. Sometimes it's interesting, what does that mean in practice? Does it mean that we should have universities for monastics? Think university for monastics is a good idea? Who thinks it's a good idea to have university for monastics? Good idea? Yeah? Yeah? Many think it's a good idea. Okay. I'm not so sure, myself. A trick question, yeah? I'm not so sure. Sometimes it can be good, sometimes not so good. Because often the learning you gain in a university is very different from the kind of learning you need to have insight into the Buddhist teachings. Universities are very kind of, it's a worldly place. It's about status. It's about, I've got a PhD. Yeah, what about you? Only got a master, that's nothing. A master, got a PhD. It's often about status and about worldly aims and about passing exams and all these kind of things. And often the way they teach Dhamma at the university is not really so inspiring. Yeah, okay, five aggregates is what they mean. 12 factors of dependent origination. But you hear about it and you feel kind of dry afterwards. You don't feel inspired. You don't feel lifted up. The Dhamma has a very different purpose in the university setting than it has on the spiritual path. So it can be useful. I think it depends a lot. What I find so fascinating is that some of the greatest spiritual masters you see around, did they ever go to university to learn Dhamma? No. Yeah. The Ajahn Shahs of the world, he could barely read and write, for goodness sake. Ajahn Brahm, he went to Cambridge University, but didn't go to university to learn about Buddhism. The Buddha didn't go to university, as far as we know. Yeah, certainly not to learn about Buddhism, because he invented Buddhism. Sometimes, I'm not so sure, I think sometimes the universities, they end up with all kind of debates and all kind of worldly knowledge rather than the real knowledge you need to practice the path. If you look at Indian history, the great history in India, Nalanda University, those of you who've been to India, you have seen that, yeah, I've been to the ruins of Nalanda, massive ruins there, and that really came about just as Buddhism started to decline. Yeah, that's when the university starts to come. And they had all these debates there and arguments and trying to understand the suttas, just like we're trying to understand the suttas now. They already started back then. Yeah, and they write commentaries and all these kind of things. And very often the ends are more worldly. And they don't actually, it is not always so, I think, so useful for spiritual insight, for deep meditation practice. It may actually often detract from that. And the more worldly aims of winning in debate, etc., tend to become more important. So I'm not so sure about these universities. Sometimes I think it may be more have more negative effects than it has positive effects. But we live in a world that believes in education in universities. So it's kind of, that's part of the problem, I think. Anyway, the Buddha went to these spiritual teachers, those teachers that were in existence at that time. The first one of these was Alara Kalama, and he's also talked about in a few other places in the Pali Canon. And the second one we have here is Uddaka Ramaputta. We'll see it in a second. And in other places, it says that he also went to other spiritual teachers. They're not actually mentioned here, but the other ones as well. So he tried a variety of teachers. So let's see what happens when he goes to Alara Kalama. Having gone forth, Bhikkhu, in search of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Alara Kalama and said to him, "Friend Kalama, I want to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline." Alara Kalama replied, "The Venerable One may stay here. This Dhamma is such that the wise man can soon enter upon and abide in it, realizing for himself, through direct knowledge, his own teacher's doctrine. I soon learned that Dhamma. As far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of the teaching went, I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed, I know and see, and there were others who did likewise." So he goes to Alara Kalama, yeah, he has gone forth and seeking what is wholesome, what is good, and also seeking the supreme state of sublime peace. Remember, the Buddha doesn't really know what he's looking for. Yeah, at this point, he doesn't really know whether there is a Nibbana or not, but he's searching for something that is beyond death and birth, freedom from all of these things. So he's looking for the highest bliss or peace, but he doesn't actually know whether such a thing even exists at this particular stage. So he goes to these teachers, and the first one he goes to is Alara Kalama, and he accepts him as a disciple. And the Buddha, to be, thinks, "I considered, it is not through mere faith alone that Alara Kalama declares. By realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and abide in this Dhamma. Certainly Alara Kalama abides, knowing and seeing this Dhamma." Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, "Friend Kalama, in what way do you declare that by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge, you enter upon and abide in this Dhamma?" In reply, he declared the base of nothingness. So here, what is happening here is that, first of all, the Buddha-to-be, he learns the teaching orally. Yeah, in those days, the teachings were all passed on orally from teacher to student. And this is what the Buddha-to-be does here. He learns it orally. This is why it's called lip reciting and this kind of things. But obviously, that is only the beginning. Just like the suttas, first of all, you read them. And then once you have read them, you start practicing accordingly. So the Buddha asks him, the Buddha-to-be asks him, "Well, what does all this mean?" Yeah, and then he says, "Well, the base of nothingness, the akinsa yatana, is what he is talking about here." And the akinsa yatana is normally understood to be similar to the third of the four immaterial attainments in Buddhism. Yeah, you have the four jhanas, and then beyond that you have the immaterial attainments. And the akinsa yatana is the third one of those four immaterial attainments. That is what is normally is understood as. Whether it really means that in this context or not, I'm not 100% sure. And there are some good reasons for perhaps doubting that that actually means that. Because if he had gone that far on the path, then certainly he would have had been very close to Nibbana already, because you get very close as this, you get this very deep states of meditation. And there are some reasons. I'm not going to go into detail about that. If you're interested, you can ask me. But if you're not interested, then we can just kind of leave it as it is. But what it does, though, it kind of completes the story of the Buddha very nicely. Yeah, if he had attained the base of nothingness, and the next teacher, Uddaka Ramaputta, he actually attains the base of neither perception or non-perception, which is the fourth immaterial attainment. If he had attained all of those things, it means that he would have gone all the way to the maximum samadhi possible and still didn't find awakening. Yeah. So on the one hand, he went to the maximum of samadhi. On the one hand, he tried sensual pleasures to the maximum. On the third hand, he practiced ascetic practices to the maximum. He tried everything. And then he had to find the fourth way, if you like, which was the way of insight afterwards. So it fits the story. But sometimes the story is just too neat. Yeah. So if things are too neat, that also is kind of maybe grounds for doubt as well. I'm not sure. Maybe it is. Anyway, let's just leave that alone. But obviously, they had very good samadhi, and that was the main point of this. I consider not only Alara Kalama has faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and panya, wisdom. I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and panya. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Alara Kalama declares he enters upon and abides in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. So here the Buddha to be is looking at his spiritual faculties. Do I have the ability to realize what Alara Kalama has realized? Yeah? And he looks at himself and he sees, I also have these qualities. These five things you see here, they are very similar to the spiritual faculties. Yeah? Energy, faith, mindfulness, all of these things. But are they really the spiritual faculties, or are they something just similar to the spiritual faculties? And they cannot really be the actual spiritual faculties, because the spiritual faculties actually means that you are already a stream enterer, yeah? The spiritual faculties means you have perfect faith in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Well, he doesn't even know about Buddhism yet. How on earth can he have perfect faith in the Buddha or the Dhamma? He hasn't even found the answer to these things. The insight of the spiritual faculty is the insight of the arising and passing away of phenomena. It is the direct insight into impermanence. Obviously he hasn't got that. So obviously cannot really mean the five spiritual faculties in any ordinary way. Here it must mean something less than that. What is interesting, one of the things I was talking about before, is that very often one of the ways of judging the validity of certain statement in the suttas is to compare it to the same sutta handed down in other traditions. And there is a parallel to this sutta in the Chinese Agamas. And in that Chinese Agamas, it doesn't have the five spiritual faculties here. What it has instead is just saddha, faith, energy, and panya. Yeah? It doesn't have even mindfulness and samadhi in there. Which is quite interesting here. How come the Pali has five? How come the Chinese version only has three here? What's going on here? How can we explain this difference? Very often, these suttas are exactly the same. And the interesting thing is that the version in Chinese of this particular sutta is actually quite a lot simpler than the Pali version. Pali version is more expansive. If you know the suttas, you will know that later on, after the Buddha's awakening, he thinks, this Dhamma is very difficult, should I teach it or not? And then Brahma Sahampati comes down and says, please, people who have little dust in their eyes are perishing because you're not teaching the Dhamma. Well, that whole thing does not even exist in the version that is in Chinese. It's not there. He doesn't think, should I teach the Dhamma or not? He just starts teaching. There's no Brahma Sahampati coming and interfering. So which one is right? And generally speaking, the Chinese version is simpler, and the simpler version is often more right, more original. Things are often added to the suttas later on. So I think that it is quite possible that the version that it is found in Chinese translation may be more likely. It only has the three of the five faculties: saddha, energy, virya, panya, wisdom. Those three here. And the other thing here is that because the five faculties is a standard set, Yeah, it's the standards that you find throughout the suttas. It is more likely that what is an odd idea, very odd idea, just faith, energy, and wisdom is not the standard set at all. It's more likely that has been standardized into the five faculties, rather than the five faculties have lost two and somehow ended up with three here. Yeah, another reason why the version in Chinese is more likely to be early in this particular context. Yes. Okay, let me back you in a second on that one. Yeah, just remind me in a second. I'll come back to you in a second. I'll just finish off the train of thought here, and then I can come back to that one here. So what that might mean, if it is true that there's only the three are correct in this particular context, it means that samadhi is not in there. Yeah, mindfulness is not even in there. And of course, if samadhi isn't in there, then it is very unlikely that the base of nothingness in this particular case really refers to the base of nothingness. Maybe it refers to some lesser attainment that had that particular name but wasn't actually the same as we have in the Pali Suttas. Anyway, this is a lot of speculation for you, and it's kind of hard to get one's mind fully around this. It doesn't really matter so much for the flow of the story. It is just interesting. This is the kind of things that, you know, sometimes you get into talking about when you do comparative study, because these are the things that stand out when you compare the suttas to each other. So, can we rely on the Pali Sutta? That's the next question. Maybe they are dodgy. Yeah, maybe they are really. Maybe there's not. Maybe we have to be careful what we read. Maybe the Eightfold Path is only sevenfold. Yeah, maybe samadhi is not necessary. I'm being naughty now. Yeah, so I don't take me too literally here. Yeah, sure. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. So, the point is that this here is a fairly kind of is a side issue, really, as far as the suttas are concerned. What matters is that all of the main categories, all the main teachings are almost exactly the same, whether you read them in Chinese, Tibetan, Sanskrit, Pali, English. Yeah, English is a new version of the suttas. Almost exactly the same. The Eightfold Path is the same. The Four Noble Truths are the same. Dependent origination is the same. So those teachings that are core teachings of the Buddha, and there's almost no variation at all. So basically, you can be sure about those teachings. But the smaller things, the little side issues, there is more room for doubt. Even there, there's often a lot of similarity between the various versions. I mean, even here, the Chinese version and the Pali version, actually, they're very close. Yeah, there's lots of similarities. There's a tiny little thing that are different between the two, which makes it interesting here. And there are some obvious cases where we use the Chinese versions to help us correct the Pali, because the Pali is obviously missing something here. There's one sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya where the Buddha says, oh, you know, I will teach you six things. Then he only says five. Yeah, and so one is missing. And the commentary says, well, there's this additional category, yeah, that should be added in there. Then you go to the Chinese and it has all six categories there. So sometimes it can be very helpful to add the Chinese translation to get a kind of different perspective on these things. Okay, but you don't need to worry too much about those things, because the Pali is already plenty good enough to give you the what is going on. Yeah, the essence of these things and the main aspects of the Dhamma is all there. Okay, so the Buddha decides, maybe I should try it out. Yeah, see what happens if you do this. And the Buddha then says, I soon entered upon and abided in that Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, Friend Kalama, is it in this way that you declare that you enter upon and abide in this Dhamma by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge? That is the way, friend. It is in this way, friend, that I also enter upon and abide in this Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. And then Alara Kalama says, it is a gain for us, friend. It is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our companion in the holy life, so that the Dhamma that I declare enter upon and abide in by realizing for myself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that I declare I enter upon and abide in by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dhamma that I know, and I know the Dhamma that you know. As I am, so are you. As you are, so am I. It kind of goes on for a bit. Anyway, come friend, let us now lead this community together. And I like this kind of things. Yeah, it's really kind of nice, you know, you get another companion and someone else who has the same realization as you have. And instead of saying, kind of being jealous or being upset by it, you say, yeah, okay, now let's be teachers together. Yeah, you sit over here, I sit over here, and we kind of teach together from now on. It's kind of nice, isn't it? And so obviously someone who has some very good spiritual qualities who is acting in this way and doing things in this way. Thus, Alara Kalama, my teacher, placed me, his pupil, on an equal footing with himself and awarded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, earlier translated as revulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, to nibbana, but only to reappearance in the base of nothingness, not being satisfied with that Dhamma, disappointed with it, I left. So the Buddha is seeking for the end to death, to the end of problems, and he realizes that whatever attainment you have in samadhi, it leads to rebirth, it leads to continuation of the round of samsara, not to a complete end. Yeah. And even though he gets the honor of being placed on the same footing as Alara Kalama, that's not really good enough for the Buddha to be. He is kind of beyond that kind of a track, and is very serious in his spiritual search. And so he leaves all those honors behind, and then tries to find the deeper truth. He is very a lot of integrity and purpose in his search for truth here. So. This is what he is. So then he leaves, and then he moves on, and he goes to his second teacher. Still in search, because of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Uddaka Ramaputta and said to him, "Friend, I want to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline." Uddaka Ramaputta replied, "The Venerable One may stay here. This Dhamma is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and abide in it, himself realizing through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. I quickly learned that Dhamma as far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of his teaching went. I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed I know and see, and there were others who did likewise. I considered it was not through mere faith alone that Rama declared, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and abide in this Dhamma. Certainly Rama abided knowing and seeing this Dhamma. Then I went to Uddaka Ramaputta and asked him, "Friend, in what way did Rama declare that by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, he entered upon and abided in this Dhamma?" In reply, Uddaka Ramaputta declared the base of neither perception nor non-perception. So very similar to the previous one, this is what you normally have in this oral literature to make it easy to remember. It is quite strange that the way it is, things are spoken here is a bit different from normally in the suttas. For example, after learning everything through lip reciting and rehearsal, in other words, learning things orally, he claims, "I know and see." Usually, "I know and see" in Buddhism means that you have insight. Yeah, here it means understanding it orally, which is kind of unusual. And I think this points to the idea that, you know, here we are before the Buddha's awakening, and before the Buddha's awakening, he uses the vocabulary a bit differently from after his awakening. Before his awakening, he's still kind of, you know, trying to find the truth. Once the awakening is there, then he has to think about how am I going to declare my new teachings to my students. And he uses the existing vocabulary that exists in India, and he gives it a new meaning according to his own teachings. You see what I'm trying to say here, yeah? So he uses existing ideas and terms and gives them new meaning. For example, arahat. The word arahat, we probably see this, like, had already existed in India at the time. But when the Buddha reaches his awakening, he gives it a new meaning. Tathagata already existed at that time. He gives it a new meaning here. Jhana, the word jhana already existed, gives it a new meaning here. I know and see, no knowledge and vision, seem to have it already existed, yeah? At that time it seemed to have meant just lip reciting and oral tradition. Once the Buddha starts teaching, it means insight into the nature of reality here. So this is one of the things the Buddha does. He takes the existing standards, existing vocabulary, gives them a new meaning, and then they become Buddhist terms instead as a consequence of that. One of the things that you see. It's obvious that the Buddha also was a product of Indian civilization, the Indian way of life. He had to use the language that existed. So an important thing to keep in mind when you read these suttas. And the other interesting thing here, yeah, and this is what is interesting. In the previous one, it was Alara Kalama who had actually himself realized this state of nothingness. Here, it is not Uddaka Ramaputta who has realized this, it's Rama. Uddaka Ramaputta means literally Uddaka, the son of Rama. Putta is son, yeah? So he seems to be like the spiritual son of the spiritual heir of this other person called Rama. And here, you see, it is not he that has declared this. It is the spiritual teacher. He probably has passed away already. This is probably a lineage that has been passed down. It is Rama himself, an ancient teacher, who actually is here said to have said these things. So what's going on here? Why is this? Well, it's a little bit too strange. Well, how come Buddha Ramaputta? What was he doing? Was he just messing around and kind of learning lip recitation, not really understanding what is going on here? And it is very fascinating because sometimes, you know, scholars of Buddhism, they argue that, there's nothing really kind of these suttas, you don't know what is mythology and what is legend and what is made up and how can you tell the difference, yeah? But this little thing here is very weird. How can you explain this unless it comes from some real historical incident? If it was just made up, then surely if it was made up, then Uddaka Ramaputta would have been the one who, you know, who had the insight, yeah? But no, it changes. It's not Uddaka Ramaputta, it's some ancient sage called Rama. He is the one who has that insight. And this has been argued by some scholars to show that the ancient suttas, they actually contain even the historical information often is preserved, perhaps in a very proper way, yeah, has been passed down properly over the centuries and millennia. So these little quirks, these tiny little things like that, yeah, which you hardly notice it when you read it, unless somebody points it out to you, don't even see this. I didn't see this until somebody pointed this out to me. Said, yeah, that's right, that's pretty weird, isn't it? So it's Rama, this sage who isn't even there, who had this insight into neither perception or non-perception. And it's a little quirk that seems to be likely to stem from the very earliest tradition of Buddhism, from when the sutta probably was originally handed down by the Buddha or whoever it was. I'm just pointing these things out to you. I hope you find this interesting. If you don't find it interesting, then I don't know what to say. It's problematic. So just tell me tonight, yeah, not interesting. We want, you know, do something, please. It's okay, you can say that. Okay. I considered not only Rama had faith, energy, mindfulness, stillness, and wisdom. I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, stillness, and wisdom. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. I soon quickly entered upon and abided in that Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Uddaka Ramaputta and asked him, "Friend, was it in this way that Rama declared that he entered upon and abided in this Dhamma by realizing for himself with direct knowledge That is the way, friend. It is in this way, friend, that I too enter upon and abide in this Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. It is a gain for us, friend. It is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our companion in the holy life. So the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that Rama declared entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dhamma that Rama knew, and Rama knew the Dhamma that you know. As Rama was, so are you. As you are, so was Rama. Come, friend, now lead this community. Yeah? So now, because Rama is already gone, yeah? So nobody knows what happened to Rama. He's probably his ancient sage. The Buddha has realized the same thing as Rama realized. So they put him on top, yeah? He becomes the new leader because he has realized the same thing as Rama did. So now he, that's why he says, now you lead this community. Yeah? It fits with this idea that it was Rama, not some existing person, but some deceased person who realized these things. Thus, Uddaka Ramaputta, my companion in the holy life, placed me in the position of a teacher and accorded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment or revulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, to Nibbana, but only to reappearance in the base of neither perception nor non-perception, not being satisfied with what Dhamma, disappointed with it, I left. So again, the Buddha is not interested in worldly honors. He's not interested in just leading a community. He wants to discover the truth for himself. That is why he becomes the Buddha, because of this one-pointed, this is all I'm interested in, finding the truth. Everything else is irrelevant. Yeah, no messing around. In this case, of course, the base of neither perception nor non-perception is the fourth of the immaterial attainments. I should perhaps say that the idea of base is a kind of strange translation again. The Pali word is ayatana. And ayatana means like a stretching out. Aya is like a cross. Ayatana is stretching out, yeah? So it means something like maybe the plane, yeah? The plane of neither perception, non-perception. Or maybe even the realm, yeah? The realm of neither perception, non-perception. That to me is something I can relate to. A realm or a plane might be somewhere like you are born, place you are born into. The word base, I'm not sure if I really understand what that means in this particular context. So I would prefer to translate as plane or realm, or maybe even sphere, yeah, the sphere of these things. It's like an area or that you actually get reborn into in this way. But again, I am not entirely sure whether it really refers to the fourth immaterial attainment, just like the previous one. I think it might very well refer to something less in this particular case. Okay. So please, as we go along, you're more than welcome to ask questions as we go through this. If you have any doubts about anything or something is not quite clear or whatever, please do so. So then he abandons all his teachers, and now, having given up on the teachers, he strikes out on his own, and he now is trying to find the truth by himself. Yeah, that's much more difficult when you have no teacher anymore and you have to kind of figure everything out for you on your own. He has gone as far as people are able in ancient India to teach him Dhamma, teach him spiritual practice, and he's not satisfied with what he has found. This is what happens next. Still in search, bhikkhus, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I wandered by stages through the Magadhan country until eventually I arrived at Uruvela at Sena Nigama. There I saw an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing river, with pleasant smooth banks, nearby a village for alms resort. I considered this is an agreeable piece of ground. This is a delightful grove with a clear flowing river, with pleasant smooth banks and a nearby a village for alms resort. This will serve for the striving, for a clansman intent on striving. I sat down there thinking, this will serve for striving. So now the Buddha arrives at Bodh Gaya. This place called Uruvela is later on called Bodh Gaya, the place of awakening. And this is where he goes, still in search of exactly the same thing. Wandering in stages, this means that it's a long trip, so he kind of goes gradually, day by day or whatever. And it's quite interesting, the kind of the place that he finds here. He finds an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing river, obviously so you can bathe, maybe drink, and nearby you have a village for alms resort. Go in and get his alms in the village. And this kind of is a precursor for later on when he discovers the middle way. Remember, he hasn't even discovered the middle way yet. He's still kind of fumbling around in the dark, trying to find his way through this samsara, just like the rest of us. He hasn't found the middle way yet. But this is almost like a precursor to that, a metaphor for that. He doesn't kind of find a dangerous jungle or anything like that. He finds a place that is where he can be agreeable, where he can be at peace, at ease, and relax. And this is the place. And having food nearby, the river there, and all these things, is obviously quite a beautiful place of nature. And this is actually one of the things that you do find in the suttas in many places, that the monastics, they often delight in nature. Nature is one of the things that you can delight in as monastic. I often like to quote the verses by Mahakasapa. You know Mahakasapa? This very austere monk. He's very famous, especially in the Mahayana tradition, or some of the Mahayana tradition. Some of the schools, he's the founder of some of the schools of Buddhism. I think maybe some of the, I can't remember which schools now exactly, but he is the beginning, and he kind of one of the main disciples of the Buddha, and the famous story, I think it's in Mahayana, where the Buddha just shows him a lotus and he smiles and the transmission has been accomplished, I wish it was that simple, but that's the story there anyway. So Mahakasapa is famous for being very austere, only wearing robes that are very kind of coarse and all of these things. Sometimes he's talking to Venerable Ananda in the suttas, and he's always talking to Ananda as if Venerable Ananda is a little boy and he is kind of the real monk. And he he's quite tough, the way his whole appearance. But what is interesting, this really tough monk, who is supposed to be an arahant as well, he can't be that tough if an arahant, he must be quite soft inside. And of course, but his verses, he talks about, wow, these beautiful mountains, beautiful mountains with tall trees, and the birds kind of flying around. It is so beautiful and so delightful. You see there, these kind of really very austere people, arahants, they are still delighting in nature. It is fascinating, because people often think, well, isn't nature just another kind of sensual pleasure? And it is. It is something you get through the senses. So it is the sensual pleasure in a very refined sense. It's a very refined kind of sensual pleasure. And it is a sensual pleasure that tends to lead you to peace. I don't know if you notice that when you are in nature, you tend to become peaceful. If you come down to Bodhinyana Monastery, you come to Jhana Grove, and you hang out with the kangaroos for a while, after a while you feel a bit quite peaceful. The kangaroos look at you, and you kind of look back at the kangaroos. And it kind of feels nice. It feels kind of soft and friendly. The trees are very large. There's kind of the breeze going through the trees. And nature has a natural calming effect on us, where the city is the exact opposite. City has a kind of exciting effect. Run faster. Go here, go there, do things. It always tells you to enjoy the latest, whatever it is. The city is a place where you enjoy sensual pleasures. You go to cafes, you date people, you do all these kind of things. That's what the city really is about. Entertainment and also hard work, of course, and all these kind of things. So nature is always a place of peace. And so it is for Mahakasapa. So it is here for the Buddha to be. Yeah, you hang out in nature in the right way here. And this is one of the things that is going on here, and why this is so suitable. So, you know, this is one of the reasons why it is so nice sometimes to get away from KL. Yeah, I don't want to say anything bad about KL. I'm sure KL is just like any city; it has its good sides and bad sides. But sometimes it's just nice to get away from the city, regardless of what city it is, and go out into the country. Yeah, places like Jama Grove or somewhere else where it is kind of peaceful and you have a different feeling about things. There's something nice about sometimes going far away from where you normally live, because it gets you out of your normal habits, your normal patterns of thinking. And when you do that, it opens up your mind to new possibilities, to new ways of looking at the world. So when you come down to Jhana Grove, to Perth, you think, wow, yeah, all your attachments are kind of away now. You're kind of more open to things. That often enables you to look at things in a different way and can be quite beneficial there. I'm not trying to tell you that you should come to Jhana Grove. You're very welcome if you want to. You don't have to. But I actually like it at Jhana Grove. I find it a very suitable, very nice place to be here. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so this is what is going on here. And then after the Buddha has this, Buddha to be has decided, this is where I'm going to hang out. Then the next thing that happens is this three famous similes that come up next. But maybe I shall stop there. It's 3:15. I started 15 minutes late. I apologize for cutting the Dhamma short 15 minutes. It's a terrible thing to do. I forgot that it was supposed to be 2:15, even though it was my suggestion. Yeah, that's pretty bad. Let's stop there so we get back on track again, and then we come back in 10-15 minutes, 3 o'clock, and we'll continue then here. Bobby, can I ask you one thing here?